Welcome, everyone, to the second of 10 dialogues being convened by the McGill Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism in honor of the center's 10th anniversary. My name is Megan Bradley. I'm a professor in the Political Science Department and the International Development Studies Program here at McGill, and I'm a member of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. As many of you will know, the center is based in the Faculty of Law here at McGill, and it's a focal point for legal and interdisciplinary research, dialogue, and outreach on the intersection of human rights issues and legal pluralism. The center's mission is to provide students, faculty, and the broader community with the opportunity to really engage in critical reflection on how the law shapes and responds to major social challenges. Given this mission, the first dialogue in the anniversary series with professors Colleen Shepherd, Frédéric Maigret, and René Provost discussed the broad question of legal pluralism and human rights. And today we'll be building on that conversation with a session focused on issues of migration and transnational labor. Now, this is clearly a really timely moment for a conversation on these issues. As we often hear on the news, there are more people on the move around the world as a result of conflict and natural disasters than at any point since World War II. But we see actually that there are even more people who are moving within their own countries and transnationally in search of labor opportunities and a better life for themselves and their families. In many cases, mobility in relation to labor needs is critically intertwined with factors that push people from their homes. Questions of international mobility, including in relation to transnational labor flows, raise important questions about the relationship between human rights protection, well-being, and development challenges, which are very much on the international agenda today. These questions and challenges are ones where a lot of research is ongoing, as well as practice with policymakers. So it's fitting that I'm joined today by two colleagues from the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, who really exemplify the center's tradition of engaged scholarship on human rights. On my left is François Crépeau, who is the new director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. He's also the Hans and Tamar Oppenheimer Chair in Public International Law in the Faculty of Law here at McGill. His research and teaching focuses on migration law, immigration and refugee law, and constitutional law. And he's also certainly well known for his work as UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Migrants. And on my left, Adele Blackett is a William Dawson Scholar and Professor in the Faculty of Law, where she directs the Labor Law and Development Research Laboratory. Adele has worked extensively, in addition to her scholarship, with the International Labour Organization, as well as with the Quebec Human Rights Commission. So it's a pleasure to have the chance to be part of this conversation today. We're aiming for a quite free-ranging discussion of these issues, and I'm also looking forward to questions from the audience later in the session. So I think we'll just kick the conversation off with a more personal question. It would be great to know how you became engaged in these issues professionally and also in terms of your research. So Adele, maybe we can start with you.
Well, first, thank you very much for the opportunity to be a part of this series. I came to international and transnational labor law quite early on, and it was first and foremost from being part of a community that has a long history in Canada, but for whom many of the people of the black community in Canada have come through migration. And so I was quite interested in the reasons why people would leave their home, the reasons why they would come to a place like Canada. It's not a neutral choice, and very much influenced by the kind of framework, the kinds of openings that are made available to communities to come to different countries and really to start new lives. The focus on transnational labor law became crystallized for me when there was, in I think especially in Montreal, right, some very determined actions on the part of activists, community groups, thinkers in intellectual contexts, and also politicians. Our mayor at the time, Jean Doré, and subsequently some federal governmental actors took a really strong stand on apartheid in South Africa. And that had a huge influence on me to think about a system in which an entire political structure, of course, was built around a racial divide, so the very important human rights dimension to that, the dispossession dimension to that as well, but also labor, apartheid as a system of labor on the basis of which an entire social structure, an entire state was built. And that helped me to really spend time thinking about how one would understand regulation in a social context, regulation that could entrench inequality or regulation that could foster meaningful social justice. And so I've paid particular attention to moments like the South African moment now 20 years later, moments of transition, but also moments of deep questioning about the relationship between labor, understood transnationally to mean not only across borders, but also to mean the range of actors who were involved in formulating the law and the range of ways in which one can undertake social change. So beyond just the state regulating, but truly a pluralist approach to thinking about the law. So I can't say that all of that was crystallized when I was in high school. That took some time. But certainly that moment of deep change, and when I started law school, Nelson Mandela was being freed, and frankly, it really just came together that labor law and human rights law were very deeply intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Adele. And Francois, how did you get involved in this field?
I studied law with the idea of becoming a business lawyer, a successful one.
It was a great plan for you.
Yep, and it didn't pan out that way. When I was doing doctoral studies in Paris, I discovered that this was boring me to death. And so I had to find something else. And I did this little degree in legal sociology. And there was a center, a research center, on legal sociology in the University of Paris. And it had been famous in the 60s and 70s for work on family law reform in particular. And so I applied to be a research assistant. And I was introduced to the director of the center, who asked me, do you want to work on mental illness or on immigration? And I had to answer within 2 or 3 seconds, and I answered immigration. You know, I was caught off, you know, by surprise, and I answered immigration, and I never stopped ever since. What happened is that the center was doing research on the implementation of social policies to young immigrants and nomads, gypsies, in French banlieues, in Parisian banlieues. And so we did for 3 years, I participated for 3 years as a research assistant into these extraordinary journeys through the deep banlieue system, visiting clandestine butcher shops and clandestine mosques, and talking to school teachers who were crying all through the interview, and talking to street educators, talking to people working for the city hall, and trying to figure out. And the question was, should we try to create social policies that are dedicated to special categories of population, trying to identify what their needs are, but at the same time marginalizing because they're not inside the mainstream social policy framework? Or should we try to include them into the mainstream social policy framework so as not to marginalize them, But then the risk is we risk forgetting their special needs. And so the question was about this youth in those French, in those Parisian banlieues, and it was about seeing whether they were more marginalized by mainstreaming or by addressing their needs. And while doing this work, I discovered my doctoral research subject matter, which was asylum seekers. The word asylum seeker appeared in the media degradable language around 1982, 1983. It did not exist before. It appeared at that time. And no one knew exactly what it was, and so I decided to do my doctorate on that, and then moved on to more generally the human rights of migrants and the relationship between human rights and mobility. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the story.
So, yeah, and here you are today.
Yep.
When you think back on the changes that you've seen over the years that you've been involved in research and practice on transnational labor and mobility issues, what strikes you as the most profound changes that you've seen, or maybe the landscape hasn't actually changed as much as one might expect?
So really interesting question. And certainly in the world of work, a lot has changed, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of the assumptions around the stability of employment, around mm-hmm. how entire societies that built the delivery of a range of social entitlements, right? The entire social welfare state of most states in the global north, and many states that tried to emulate that model in the global south, is kind of called into question when employment and a standard employment relationship is profoundly challenged. And by that I mean the assumption that a nuclear family will have one primary breadwinner, right, who will work more or less 9-to-5 job, a job that he will enter soon after high school, right, and maintain through to retirement. And around that job will be based unemployment insurance, health protection or contributions to it by the employer, so supporting a state-based system, pensions, a range of other benefits, and the ability to exercise leisure, right? And so we've seen, of course, some really important changes to that model, including a female workplace entry in wide scale, because of course some women always worked, right? Part of the margins, especially women from marginalized communities. But that model has since, some would situate it the end of the 1970s with the oil crisis, others later, has profoundly broken down. And so to the extent that it was ever entirely sustainable at the time, the concerns and the views vary widely are either that it's not sustainable, or there isn't political will to sustain it, or there isn't an economic landscape that feels a need to maintain it. Whatever the perspective, we're in a profound rethinking of that framework, and for developing countries in particular, the ability to even come close to that model could rarely be assumed coming out of, for many, colonialism, and coming out of mm-hmm. an economic structure where informality of the labor market was more the norm mm-hmm. Than this standard employment relationship. So this is a much bigger story, but I think understanding the extent to which we've moved away, and sometimes just stating it, right? Stating that paradigm is to state the extent to which we're no longer really in that paradigm poses immense challenges to regulation. And when labor law is increasingly seen as a subject that can hardly be regulated nationally or exclusively regulated by any one nation state because competitive factors, movement of products across borders, production overseas, production in lower cost areas and lower productivity areas, with productivity being the key factor from a trade perspective, but the relationship between cost and productivity being increasingly hard to separate, with people moving to deliver the services, and the, I would emphasize that we have really reimagined what service delivery means. So we talk, for example, about the provision of services in agriculture, whereas historically we might have just talked about that as production, right? But this for reframing in terms of services enables access to movement of persons mechanisms that then call for different regulatory options. And there are countless examples of this that our shorthand, globalization, allows us to understand. So if it becomes harder and harder for any given state to regulate in a manner that ensures jobs and ensures particular kinds of conditions, then what are the opportunities, what are the possibilities, and what are the risks of imagining regulation at different governance levels? Some that we create, regional agreements, some that, and we, in that case, is the states that states create, some that individual actors create by attempting to organize transnationally, some transnational union coordination, framework agreements. What is, at an ethical level, the extent of our responsibility globally? Iris Marion Young speaks to this challenge. Some of the initiatives that have sprung up, like the responses through the Bangladesh Fire and Safety Accords around the Rana Plaza disaster that occurred, with that has involved a range of actors, corporations, international organizations like the ILO, International Labor Organization involved in that, or Better Work initiatives where the World Bank, along with the ILO, helped to fund countrywide monitoring in an entire sector of the economy of a small developing country, right? Really different regulatory responses to the challenge of labor that all come back to something that the ILO recognized since 1919, and that was that the foundation of the way we think about labor, it has to be a social justice foundation.
So, Francois, I think it goes without saying that the past decades have been one of huge change in terms of the mobility of people. So I'm curious to hear your reflections on that, but in particular, how do you think the changes that you've seen over the time that you've been working in this area intersect with the changes that Adele has raised about the challenges around regulation, for example, which is a huge challenge, clearly, when we're talking about the movement of people?
Yes, I think my take on it is really intertwined with what Adele just said. Migration is, I often define migration as being the normal state of mankind. That's been part of who we are as human beings forever, since we seem to have come all from one woman in East Africa 200,000 years ago, and we've conquered the world several times over since then. And our predecessors, before our species, had done the same before that. So we are a migratory species. That's who we are. Border controls, as we know them today, apart from wartime, date back to the late or second half of the 19th century. That's a very recent thing. People were not stopped at borders historically, except Japan, etc. But these are historical examples that have varied. But the ability to travel was limited. Most of mankind traveled on foot forever. And so apart from the past few centuries where we've had very organized movements of people, the slave trade was one obvious example, but also the populating of the Americas with the block settlement policies for Western Canada, for example, at the end of the 19th century or early 20th century, were also very organized policies. The Gastarbeiter program in Germany after the Second World War, the call by countries like France and the UK on the population of their former colonies to come for industrial work after the Second World War, all these were pretty organized mechanisms. What has changed somewhere between the end of the 70s and the early 80s is that individuals have started to move on a regular basis across continents, across the seas. And that is something that was relatively new. So that's when, for example, the word asylum seeker appeared, because suddenly, instead of having refugees waiting in camps in Thailand, for example, for the Indochinese refugees of the 70s, we had people popping up at the border and asking for asylum. That was striking, and the numbers grew very quickly in the early 80s. So this has changed also the relationship. As long as those programs of mass migration were organized by states, states had standard procedures, had social programs, albeit reduced to their minimum, but there were conditions that were provided. There was a minimum level of health care, there were pensions, they were not necessarily transportable, but there was a pension system. You know, states had provided a number of social safeguards. What happens when people come on their own, quite massively, is that states were not prepared, and states were not ready to provide the same services. And if we talk about change in regulatory mechanisms, that's one of the changes that states faced. When you have an undocumented population in your country, how do you cope? When you have many people who come for work in various industries, when you try to organize temporary migrant worker programs, which have to vary from industry to industry because the requirements of the employers are not the same, this creates a very, very complex situation which is difficult to regulate. And very often the baseline, the starting point for thinking through those programs when they exist or the protection of the individuals when no program exists was not human rights. It was not the protection of the individual's rights. It was the need of the industry, is what the employers were ready to pay, or it was for the exploitation of undocumented worker. The triggering of intervention by state was when you had complaints. And very often, undocumented workers don't complain because they fear something which is worse than the exploitation they suffer in their minds, which is the return to the country of origin. So very often what happened is that all those mobility mechanisms became a very complex structure, which states had never thought they would have to manage. And it created a strain. It created situations of exploitation and poverty and marginalization, which had not been experience in such a context. And it erupted. It was done at the same time as globalization was being theorized. And I think Adele has spoken eloquently about how globalization had affected the labor relations. But it also came when the human rights doctrine came of age. And somehow, those who had created the human rights, the basic human rights instruments at the UN, at UN level, had not really thought about the foreigners. The human rights doctrine was created as a relationship between citizen and state. And the place of the foreigner was not very well theorized, so that when creative lawyers tried to use human rights instruments in favor of migrants and succeeded in courts, for example, some states were offended. For example, the first time that Canada was condemned by the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations for the treatment of a foreigner whom Canada wanted to send back to a country where he could face persecution, Canada's Foreign Service was up in arms. This is not why we had signed the Convention Against Torture. It was not to threaten this essential element of territorial sovereignty, mm-hmm. which is the treatment of foreigners. And so what we have seen happening in the past 15 to 20 years is this great game, I would say, mm-hmm. between states defending territorial sovereignty as they conceive it, which is the ability to do whatever they want with foreigners who are not citizens and therefore should not be entitled to the same protections as citizens, and a whole human rights community which tries to implement the human rights instrument, which apply to foreigners and citizens alike. In the human rights, if we take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the two covenants, those rights apply to equally to citizens and foreigners, except for two: the right to enter and stay in the country and the right to vote and be elected. Apart from that, we share the same human rights because we're all human beings. And this is a realization that is pushed by the human rights community and quite actively resisted by many states. States that benefit from an independent judiciary and national human rights institutions that are functional are able to progressively include migrants into the human rights circle. In countries where those are dysfunctional, it's much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And yet I'm also struck by the ways in which countries that are very well capacitated erect barriers of a whole range of different kinds, you know, exercising quite impressive creativity in many cases, to prevent non-citizens from accessing those systems. People like Matt Gibney have written quite extensively on these issues. Yep. Yeah, interesting. Adele, so Francois has, I think really reminded us of the struggle and also the importance of keeping human rights in the frame when we're thinking about issues of mobility. And I'm curious about your reflections on that challenge as it relates to transnational labor. I'm sure that some of the challenges are similar, but there's probably unique factors as well.
Yeah, so it's an excellent question, because there's a huge debate in transnational labor about the extent to which human rights norms can be considered the guiding or fundamental lens through which one should understand labor. I alluded to social justice, right? Mm. As a foundational principle that for the ILO, which predates, of course, the UN system, was established in 1919 under the Treaty of Versailles, is a more encompassing principle. And the ILO has really emphasized its and labor lawyers generally, the rootedness of the field in a recognition of the fact that the worker sells his or her labor power, right? And yet, as a human being, seeks to resist commodification. And so the whole normative structure, which in international labor law is over 400 instruments, right, that are ratified almost cafeteria style by member states, but that have some level of prioritization attached to some, the idea is to build frameworks, initially very much state-based systems of labor relations, and there was a sense of interconnectedness between the states and the need for all to continue to improve standards. But this was conceptualized still within state sovereignty. But what's fascinating because of the ILO's timeline is that it covered, of course, the post-war period, the entire period of decolonization, but the ILO actually had something called the Native Labor Code in the earlier protectorate-based system and continued. And so, and they have standards on indigenous peoples' rights, in part because there was this history of the indigenous person being the native in the colonial context. Why do I mention all this? Because it links the ILO's relationship to territorial dispossession and a contemporary context in which we think about transnational labor through but beyond a human rights lens. So the original migrant was, for some, and, you know, of course, within the contemporary period, the colonized worker, dispossessed from land, forced to move internally and to become a worker and to trade their status prior to colonization with becoming a, quote, industrial man or industrial citizen, right? And very much linked to the development of productive systems. And what did those people seek? Well, they sought their human rights to work without forced labor, right, and to have the ability to assemble and to do many of the things that the ILO built into its founding norms, many of which have now been prioritized by the ILO as fundamental principles and rights at work. But those norms never worked on their own. They were never just, especially civil and political rights. Mm-hmm. They were very much rooted in the broader or holistic view of an entire framework that ensures, paradoxically, a form of citizenship at work. Mm-hmm. And scholars working at transnational level now or in transnational labor law really draw on that framing, which is limiting citizenship, and challenge it to suggest that really what we're talking about is a broader process of ensuring social justice in the world of work, which might mean the ability to not necessarily remain in a subordinated work relationship. So we're at an incredibly important moment of transition. Human rights become one way to claim that broader access, if you will, to social justice, but not the only way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Adele. That's really fascinating. And as someone who, like Francois, spends a lot of time working on issues around migration and especially refugee flows, I'm really struck in thinking about your comments about how dominant rights talk still is in my sector of academia and of practice. And I really wonder, would we be in a better position? Would it be advantageous to try to shift the frame so that when we think about people on the move, we're not using human rights as the dominant discourse, which I think at least, in scholarship and certain aspects of practice, that's definitely the case. Maybe it would be productive for us to think more in terms of social justice. I'm not sure if that's a fair question to ask the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights of migrants, but I'm curious, Francois, should we be talking more about social justice?
We certainly need to talk more about social justice generally. Mm. I mean, that's a very fair point to say. And in the space of regulated labor, I think that's what Adele's is coming from. Certainly using human rights as a tool for social justice makes sense. The problem is that many migrants, and I'm talking about migration, are not in a regulated space. And so they cannot or will not have access to other forms of legal framework. The only framework that is common to all humanity anywhere at any time are human rights. We all have them everywhere. We carry them with our bones. And they're very intrinsic to our nature. That's the definition of human rights. It's the natural law that comes back and that has infused the human rights with its global legitimacy. The if we look at constitutional frameworks, for example, the constitutional framework which has become in the past 30 years the only or the supreme legitimacy test for any social policy is the human rights framework. Mm-hmm. That's the grid against which we measure the legitimacy, the political legitimacy and the legal legitimacy of social programs, of political decisions, etc. So for many migrants, there's nothing else than human rights. Mm-hmm. And wherever they are, if their rights are trampled, they may want to use those human rights mechanisms. Very often they won't use them because starting to use human rights mechanisms, making a complaint to a human rights commission or going to court means that you stick your neck out. You identify yourself. You risk being detected, detained, deported. And this would be the end of the migration project in which so much has been invested by the migrant herself or by the whole family or the whole clan or the whole village at home. And so they often don't do that, which makes the realization of human rights for migrants very difficult. And to me, that is the point. Human rights were developed for citizens, i.e. persons who are not marginalized in their community. Citizens officially or citizens unofficially. If you are not marginalized in your community, if you don't fear claiming your rights, you will do so. You might choose to do so, and in many cases you will do so. If I am not paid what I'm owed at the end of a job, I will claim it. I will ask for it because I don't fear. But if I do fear, I might refuse to claim it. And for many migrants, the best strategy is not to claim anything. It's to move on. Moving on is the most common strategy of migrants in the face of human rights violations. And so, to me, that's where I stick to human rights for dear life, because I think that the challenge we have is to make the law, whether it be labor law or health law or education or work for the migrants. And the tools that we have at our disposal, having been made for citizens, are mostly related to the constitutional human rights framework and to the capacity of a free actor to access them. The problem is that of unfree actors. And a migrant worker, an undocumented migrant worker who's exploited, might prefer being paid 20 euros for a 10-hour day of work, being able to send 6 or 7 euros on that amount for, you know, at the end of the week back home in order to provide for the family, rather than risk losing the job in trying to battle for years to get minimum salary. And that is not their objective. Their objective is to send money home. Mm-hmm. So moving on is often the best strategy. So how can we, as human rights activists, as lawyers, as social actors, and I include in that social workers, the police, everyone who has a contact with migrants, how can we make sure that the law works also for the migrant? Also for all marginalized communities, but in my case, works also for the migrant. Be it access to justice, but also access to public services, access to schools for migrant children, access to health care for pregnant women and for people who are ill, access to all forms of social protection, access to social housing if needed. Mm-hmm. And how can we empower the migrants, even the exploited temporary migrant worker, or the undocumented migrant? How can we empower them to access those tools of citizenship that are so important for us in terms of accessing our rights and that we take sort of for granted if we are in the privileged situation of being free to ask and request the implementation of those rights? Mm-hmm. How can we make them work for others? And to me, that's a big challenge because there's lots of resistance on the parts of states, but also on the part of public opinion and of a great proportion of those citizens who would prefer that these this access to rights be reserved to the happy few, to their mm-hmm. private club of citizens.
Mm-hmm. This question of citizenship is really threaded throughout our conversation, and I'm curious about your reflections on that concept in light of the discussion we've had and the work that you've been involved in. In what ways are we seeing notions of citizenship change, evolve in light of developments in these fields?
Yeah. So it's just fascinating listening to this and many reflections in particular on the extent I agree entirely with Francois about the unfreedom experienced by the migrants and the critical need of the inclusion. But and it actually harkens back to Francois, your starting point in going into those banlieues, right? And it was sort of about immigration, but it was sort of just about the complexity of modern societies. And so I less and less see citizenship as a binary, right? And increasingly want to reflect on the quality of the citizenship that is actually enjoyed. And we've tended to get at that through anti-discrimination law, right? To be treating people in a substantively equal fashion, as our colleague Colleen Shepherd refers to, through inclusive equality. But that's getting at some of the profound disparities that we know exists and that exist in a number of fields. So my focus has been the employment relationship. And I can tell you there are many categories of workers, and not just those in so-called low-skill employment and those who have recently arrived and those who are close to retirement. There's just so many ways in which an environment of insecurity about the duration of employment leads people to remain silent about violations, right? So we hear a lot about wage theft and, right, for overtime that's kind of not remunerated and things like that. And occasionally you'll get a class action because people realize that if they respond together, they'll be able to change the way that a major corporate actor is proceeding in the workplace. But the literature increasingly suggests that the quality of the citizenship at work, and here I'm not talking about political citizenship, the citizenship at work, which is meant to be available to all workers, migrants or not, as you were saying, Francois, is actually lessened for all workers. And there's a real interconnectedness between the precarious working conditions of some, like migrants who are here on a temporary basis, and those who are here on a permanent basis or with actual Canadian citizenship, because the ability of one to accept more precarious work because of other factors like wanting to stay in Canada, like wanting to send money back, like global wage inequality, right, all influence the quality of the working environment. Right? And some people, of course, respond to that and do a blame the migrant kind of analysis, which is entirely problematic. I think one has to think about what we are doing to structures of labor governance by allowing a coexistence of deep and deeper forms of precarity to pervade. So, and this is why I really think labor law is instructive, because it names inequality, and because it emphasizes the importance of collective and structural responses. So individuals matter, absolutely, but structures matter. And ultimately that is a critically important way to rethink a language of citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, as someone who works on repatriation processes, this notion of thinking about citizenship not in terms of a binary, but in terms of its quality is something that can be, you know, half full and half empty, as something that is sometimes retained, even if it might be the preference of a person on the move to actually shed that citizenship link. Mm-hmm. These kinds of ideas are ones that really resonate with my own thinking and research. Francois, I don't know if you have any brief reflections on the citizenship question before we open it up to the audience for questions.
Yeah, a few things. We're suffering from the after effects of at least five centuries of nationalism. Mm-hmm. And so we had conceptualized, certainly in the 19th century, nationality and citizenship as the ultimate divide, the divide for which you would give your life. That was the divide. Mm-hmm. You were French or German, or you were French or English. That was the, you know, the central divide mm-hmm. for which you would give your life. I think the experience in recent years of identity by many people has created a certain level of relativism in citizenship. for many of us, our Canadian citizenship or our French citizenship or our Kenyan citizenship is not the dominant trait or the dominant feature of our identity. We may be a woman, we may be Aboriginal, we may be young, we may be an artist, we may be gay. I mean, there are so many features that define our identities. And I'm not sure that many of us, if we thought about it, would put nationality at the top of, in terms of importance of those features. And so I think that is why the human rights framework has come under challenge in the nationalist populist discourse, because it is the embodiment of that dislodging nationality from, you know, the top of the pyramid of identity features. It says that we all share the same human rights, we all share the same characteristics, and nationality should not be a mechanism for discrimination in implementing such human rights. So this is why the adaptation of most immigration states that receive immigration, which is an increasing number and covers almost all countries in the world nowadays, because most countries are at the same time countries of origin, countries of transit, and countries of destination. But the countries that receive most immigrants have been challenged in the past three decades on the issue of who belongs and who benefits from the social structure, from being part of the community. Who do you define as being part of the community who would benefit from? And that's why I think what Adele was saying about precariousness is key. Mm-hmm. What we've seen is that in the past 30 years, since the end of the post-war prosperity period, we have seen immigration states in particular create precariousness for migration, for migrants, create precariousness in order to make sure that those migrants would not claim the full citizenship treatment. If we look at the way migrants are treated in many countries, in particular in recent decades, the creation of massive programs of temporary migrant workers, often based on the sponsorship program, which means that the your whole immigration experience is linked to one employer. If you're fired, you not only lose your work, your labor contract, but you're losing your residence visa and your work permit, and you have to go home. So the employer has a lot of power over your life, over your whole life, and not only your own life, but the lives of all those who are at home and who count on you. And so there's a sense of duty here, which is huge in the type of decisions that migrants make. So we create a precarious environment. And this is where we have to be cautious with the words we use. I've long used the word vulnerable for migrants. And one doctoral student taught me, actually, that vulnerability refers to something intrinsic to the person. And precariousness refers mostly to something that's constructed around the person. And that migrants are not vulnerable. They're actually incredibly resilient. But they are put in a situation which we create as a precarious situation in order to make sure that they do what we expect them to do for the lowest cost possible. And we've done that certainly for temporary migrant workers in great numbers, but we do that also for undocumented migrants. Mm-hmm. Undocumented migration is not just happenstance, and it's not because you have these sneaky little migrants that get into the country and take the jobs of citizens. That's not how it works. Actually, the employers of the country are asking for undocumented migrants to come. They have jobs for them at those exploitative wages and conditions. And when we hear ministers of immigration say, I'll seal this border once and for all, we can always hear the whisper of that part of the business community which tells them, yes, but not too much. Don't seal it too much, so people can still go sneak into, and so we can exploit them. So there is this creation or this tolerance of a situation where you have precariousness, and that precariousness makes for something that I've said before, which is migrants don't complain. Migrants, especially undocumented migrants, but also temporary migrant workers, all those who are put in a precarious situation, they don't complain on average. They don't protest. They don't contest. They don't go to court. They don't mobilize. They don't unionize. They are incredibly resilient, as I've said, and they have their own modes of solidarity, and they create modes of solidarity, but not at a level, at the level of the political stage. Not at the level of the public debate in society. Because as soon as they do that, they're identifiable and they risk losing status and work and being sent back home. And so you have this underworld of migrant workers who has its own mode of regulation and has its own modes of solidarity and its own leaders, and that we can, whom we can meet when we, when I visited countries, I met leaders, even in countries that were very repressive and where migrants had no rights, including no rights to unionize. You can meet the leaders if you're, but it's never at political stage, and it's never in the open, and it's never, they never talk to journalists, and they don't complain. And we see that in our countries. I was I was as a member of the bar here. We knew that there were no complaints against lawyers for migrants who would be swindled by their lawyers. And we had, you know, stories. We heard stories from NGOs and from others that this had existed, but there was never any complaint. And so I think that the what I'm trying to think about is how can we provide those migrants who are stuck in a precarious situation which prevents them from going public, how can we provide them with the empowerment to fight this fear and to allow them to not only protest and contest and mobilize and unionize, but stay in the country while they do this, keep their job while they do this, benefit from fair labor rights as other workers. And to me, that comes down to the issue of citizenship. The problem we have with migration is that migrants, the essentialization of migrants is that they're always migrants. So if you have a migrant child whom would you'd like to put to school, he's not a child first. He's a migrant, an undocumented migrant first, and therefore we're going to prevent him from going to school. If you have a migrant pregnant woman who'd need to go to the hospital, we often decide, well, she's an undocumented migrant. She can't go to the hospital. If you have a migrant worker, well, he's a migrant first. And therefore, if he's undocumented, he doesn't benefit from the labor legislation. Instead of thinking the other way around, being a child first, being a woman first, being a worker first, and benefiting from all this as citizen with a small c, not necessarily the right to vote, but the right to participate in the society where we live and where we share with other members of society the economic system, the social system, the cultural system.
Thank you, François. We have a few minutes remaining, so I'd like to collect up any questions from the audience, if there are, and I'll turn it back to Adele and François. I think we have a microphone available. If you could identify yourself before asking your question, I'd appreciate it.
My name is Pranoto Iskandar, and I'm an O'Brien Fellow in Residence, so I'm interested about the issue whether there's a place for migrations in the WTO system, because I think, you know, it's a bit very unlikely to see in the near future that there will be a world migration organization, so probably there's some way for the WTO to be revived, or probably to be more broad to include, because I think there's a chance in WTO to regulate migration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Were there any other questions? Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Amin Parso. I'm coming from Lund University in Sweden. So precisely, I'm a migrant in this case.
My question, which is more than a comment, seeks some sort of reflection from the panel, is that more and particularly I'm talking about Europe and in relation to the last couple of days' decision of Swedish government, more and more we see that states are closing down those narrow spaces of mobility through avenues of, let's say, human rights, those protections from, for example, persecution for the refugees or victims of armed conflicts, and trying to direct those mobilities through more and more pushing the migrants into the more precarious state of jobs. To give a concrete example, for example, right now it's a trend in Europe, especially in Sweden, that they no longer provide refugees with a permanent status, but they provide them with a temporary status of 3 years. And upon end of these 3 years, if the host country decides that the country of origin is safe, they return or deport the people back, or in this case, the individual has to prove some sort of a labor productivity that in the last 3 years he or she has been in the part of labor market for, let's say, a particular amount of time, couple of months, and then renewal of that precarious status for more 3 years, and then after the 3 years, you need to show again more and more. So we see that an avenue of the human rights is being closed down, pushing the individuals into a precarious labor spaces of mobility. In a way, one can say labor mobility is eating human rights mobility, or human rights mobility is losing its space of effectiveness for it being so much embedded into the state relationships. That's a question or a comment.
Well, thank you for two really interesting questions and comments. We have one final, and then I'll turn it back to the panelists.
I think my question might be a good follow-up to the last one. My name is Beatrice Fiscaletti, and I'm now have an affiliation with the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism at McGill, but formerly with the Quebec Human Rights Commission. I've spent my career involved in human rights and believe in it fundamentally as much as our two speakers. In recent times, I've noticed, however, although we've always thought of it as a grand objective, standard, universal, you often use to describe it. In recent years, I've noticed increasingly, and I'm looking at the courts in particular, but perhaps governments as well, a tendency to adapt the definition and content of human rights to what national states and cultures believe is proper for their needs and interests. I'm thinking in particular, I can think of two examples. In Europe, interpretation of Convention of Human Rights that leaves a margin of appreciation for countries, which essentially makes it a little bit relative. You know, it depends on how a country sees their duty for human rights and implementing human rights. And even in Canada, a very recent decision, one wonders if the interpretation of our constitution hasn't been influenced by concerns over security issues. So if that's correct, and that there is either a tendency to retrench or to adapt our understanding of human rights, is there a way to respond to this with a general concept? Not a case-by-case argument for each issue, but a way in which we can respond in order to make these human rights truly valid objectives. And I wonder what your comments on that would be.
Thank you very much. Time is quite short, so we'll leave it there for the questions. Thank you very much. And I'll ask our panelists to keep their responses brief. Perhaps Adele, we'll start with you.
So thank you very much. Three really excellent questions. And on the first, on trade, you mentioned specifically the WTO. What we have so far is just the General Agreement on Trade and Services and its Mode 4. But I think many states, especially larger labor exporting states that have very particular development strategies linked to placing, say, their high technology personnel or their nursing personnel in different countries, have advocated drawing on a more managed form of trade through a multilateral system rather than relying on this ad hoc type of system. And I think here François and I both would advocate a more managed approach to the movement of persons. I think there is potential in trade agreements. Some regional agreements, of course, have gone quite far. Others in recognizing a free movement of persons. Others have more specific types of provisions, sometimes with specific quotas and the like. But I think what I would want to hold on to when we move to a model that, of course, is predicated on a commodification, right, is that we're dealing with human beings who have full lives, who have families, and I want to put really squarely on the table that something very fundamental has changed about the way that we think about entitlements of people and their family, migrant workers and their families, as the UN Convention is referred to, their ability to move as people, right? We asked for workers, but people came. How do we build frameworks that challenge precarity and the precarity that's constructed when people have so much left behind? And as the discussion about circular migration via trade agreements takes off and people emphasize, well, migrants might want to stay, or they might want to leave their families, they might want to return, nothing about permanent residency prevents people from returning, right? But temporary migration removes many options and creates the precarity. And this leads me to the second and third questions, because I think I believe in human rights that are not abstracted, but really understood in context. And so I resist the universalism versus relativism framing, although I completely agree that what we're getting is via certain kinds of interpretations, a real dilution of the core of human right. And I really try to go back to the notion of interdependence, right, of human rights and indivisibility. So really reaching back to the founding UN documents in the way that we understand and marshal human rights across the board, whether that's going to become an interpretive principle that will allow us to work through some of the challenges that we've explored today, we'll see. But I think it's been under theorized, certainly in our domestic decision making. I think in terms of regulatory frameworks and how we understand them and how we understand why we extend certain kinds of rights of access to territory to people or not, really reflects whether we fundamentally see ourselves as interconnected deep, and that our rights are interdependent as between people. Some other notions would be whether we're really treating our neighbor as ourselves, and understand that to be a part of our deep humanity. So I want to be working with notions understood very concretely, but that stress our ability to see our fundamental connectedness beyond states.
Thank you, Adele. We have just a few moments left. Francois, any closing remarks?
Yes. About the first question and the free trade agreements or other economic arrangements, I think that we see around the world a trend to try to facilitate certain kinds of mobility. We have examples of free movement of person zones. The EU is one. Southern Cone in Latin America is another. We see attempts to do that in Africa. For example, ECOWAS is trying to put that in place. And I think that the idea of interdependence is at the root of those attempts. And this is, to me, very important. And, you know, I've always thought, for example, that across North America, we should have a lot more free movement of persons between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. And I had hoped for a long time before 9/11 that there would be another agreement about the freedom of crossing borders, because essentially before 9/11, the only question that the border guard would ask was, all Canadian? You know, that was the only question, really. And I was hoping that this would develop. And from what I know, President George W. Bush was on his way to create a much freer border between Mexico and the U.S. when 9/11 happened and killed the whole idea for a generation. So, yes, we need a lot more of that, and we need a lot more between economic actors and political actors to make that happen. That brings me to the second and the third question, which are interlinked. The increased push for temporary precarious status and this kind of deference that the courts have for political decisions by states about migration, because migration is still about territorial sovereignty, and states should be given, governments, authorities should be given quite a lot of deference when analyzing, when trying to legitimize these decisions in terms of the human rights framework. I think what this shows is that human rights have to be concrete, cannot be abstract principles. Actually, I would say that the law has never changed the life of anyone. The law is a tool inside a political struggle, and it's the political struggle that changes our lives. In this case, and we can see that in the various struggles around human rights, women know that. As long as women didn't have the right to vote, most of the decisions about women, political decisions about women, were made by men and were essentially based on fantasies, on myths, on stereotypes about what women could and could not do and about the nature of women. When women got the right to vote, got onto the political stage, changed the program of the parties, became elected, became minister, became prime minister, the debate changed. A lot of the stereotypes, myths, and fantasies that were current 50 years ago have disappeared. There's still lots of work to do. But the political landscape in terms of women's rights has changed because women came onto the stage and expressed their voice themselves, dispelling many myths and stereotypes. This has been the same for detainees, Aboriginals, gays and lesbians. As soon as you get on the political stage and you express your voice, suddenly the mainstream, the majority, cannot suddenly say, oh yes, it's because they're like this or they're like that. Those myths are dispelled. The problem we have with migrants is that they don't have the right to vote by definition. voting rights are reserved, except at local level in the EU, voting rights are reserved to nationals, citizens. And this is something we'll have to revisit, I think, considering the level of mobility we have in this world. I personally think that voting rights should be attached to residency and taxpaying. No taxation without representation. Migrants pay taxes, and the laws apply to migrants. Migrants should be able to vote on those laws and on how those taxes are used. But that's not a debate for now. I think it's a debate for the next generation. The debate for now is how can we make the voice of migrants heard in political debates when those political debates about migration have been taken over for the past 30 years, maybe less in Canada than elsewhere, but certainly in Europe, by nationalist populist movements. The definition of the terms at political level has been made by the likes of Jean-Marie Le Pen and Nigel Farage and Georg Haider and others in Europe. They have said, like Jean-Marie Le Pen, 2 million immigrants, 2 million unemployed, making an equation which makes no sense economically, but has political traction. And the migrants do not speak up because they're not welcome on that political stage. And when we hear people saying that migrants may be terrorists and migrants bring illnesses and migrants bring insecurity and migrants steal jobs, migrants don't go to the journalists or to parliament to say, no, that's not true. And mainstream parties quite, not strangely, because it's the result of the political system we have. We've invented the best system we've ever invented to govern ourselves, electoral democracies, while politicians react to electoral gains. There's no electoral gain to be had with migrants. They don't vote. They cannot punish a politician. They cannot reward a politician. And therefore, as long as mainstream parties are not able to create a pro-immigration, pro-diversity, pro-mobility discourse that can contradict the discourse of the nationalist populist movements, we will not be able to really make the kind of gains that women and Aboriginals and gays and lesbians have made in the past decades by dispelling the myths. We still hear today that migrants steal jobs. All the social science research has proved the contrary. That's not true. But the social science cannot be quoted on the political stage. The only country where you have actually some social science being quoted is the US, and the United States are able to have this conversation. Why? Because when talking about 8 million undocumented Mexicans, you have to deal with several dozens of, several millions of Mexican-American citizens who actually vote and who care about how these Mexicans in the U.S. are treated. So there is a political consequence to what you say about undocumented migrants in the U.S., and so some politicians do care. In most other countries, we don't have this concentration. We don't have this group of former immigrants that can mobilize around such an issue in such a number as compared to the total number of the population. And therefore, politicians actually are not able to create that new discourse that we crave, because we'd like to be able to hear the voices of the migrants and to hear those voices carried through the political stage and the political debate.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. I appreciate everyone for joining us, and in particular to our panelists for a very rich discussion.
Thank you.